This week, I welcome artist Frederick Hayes to Pep Talks. Fred is from Atlanta, studied art in the Bay Area, and now lives and works in New York City. He makes drawings, paintings, and sculptures, all based on the idea of the portrait. Fred's portraits show the African-American faces that he sees in his community and in his imagination. His graphite drawings look burnished smooth and almost metallic in their sheen. And his paintings use high-key color for a direct expressionist effect. And beyond the exterior appearance of a person, Fred also creates found object assemblage sculptures that aim to describe the inside of the human psyche, the multitude of joys and anxieties that we all hide behind our careful facades. Taken all together, Fred's work shows us the full picture of personhood, inside out and outside in. A two-time Pollack Krasner Grant Fellow and NYFA NISCA Grant winner, among others, Fred has had his work placed in several major museum collections and is currently showing his work at the Provincetown Art Association and Museum through June 16, 2024, in an exhibition celebrating the 2023 Lillian Orlowski and William Fried grant recipients. And I'll put a link in the show notes. Join me in learning more about this fascinating artist and fellow Southerner who I've long admired. Be right back with Frederick Hayes. You are listening to Pep Talks for Artists, a podcast offering small words of encouragement to all those shuffling along the artist's road. I'm your host, Amy Toludo. Hello, Fred, and welcome to Pep Talks.
Hello, Amy. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you. So we met in Hudson, New York, back in the day at the late, great Jeff Bailey Gallery. And since then, I've been a big fan of your work. And you work in a few mediums, and I hope to get to all of them. But first, I thought I'd ask you about your drawings. They're kind of my favorite of your work. You work in graphite, sometimes large or smallish, like 11 by 14, but your technique is so unique to me. You do faces, portraits, heads. They seem almost burnished or polished. They seem smooth or metallic. They have sort of a high contrast sheen that I love, and they're often set against a blank background. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about your drawings and how you come up with the subjects? And also, if you wouldn't mind satisfying an art nerd question, what's your favorite lead softness?
Okay. As far as the drawings, I tend to work with all of my figurative work, portraiture, whether it's painting or whatever. All the drawings I tend to work from photographs. I've worked from photographs of family members, images that I may find on the internet. And recently, I've been going to this site where people are doing they're live streaming. I just surreptitiously photograph them while they're talking to their audience, and me included, because I've always been sort of attracted to a certain kind of a spontaneity in terms of photography, because I began my art career as a photographer, and I would go out and do a lot of street scenes. But if you're really sort of an introverted person, sometimes it gets kind of hard, and also it can get you in trouble. So over the years of like sort of feeling less and less comfortable with photographing strangers, I've just sort of, looked for new ways to come up with imagery. But I, for the most part, I've always worked from found imagery from images from various sources. Sometimes I'll make composite from those images, and it's usually sort of a combination of, you know, looking at the photograph, interpreting that look with the actual drawing, and it's just sort of a back and forth and working within how I like to make things.
So they're very like kind of almost like one foot in the real, one foot in the imagination.
Yeah, yeah. So they somewhat, some of the earlier works, now they, I'm going to say in general, for the most part, they've all been sort of, you know, just slight. I think a lot of it had to do with actually the way I draw, but there's always been a slight twist or slight interpretation from the actual photograph. And so, you know, you're just taking certain liberties and it makes small little changes to take it to a different place.
And then are you going to reveal your lead preference?
Oh, my face. Okay. Okay. Also, I forgot one of the reasons why they're sort of like really high contrast is because I used to work in charcoal. I stopped working in charcoal and I switched to graphite, but I still, my approach to it didn't change. It didn't change. just the material. And that's why that gives it that metallic look as well. But I don't know. It's hard to say which one. I think
You're a soft lead.
Yeah, I'm a soft lead. But then I like the high contrast, like a 9B.
Oh, wow.
Like a really dark B.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll use that a lot of times to get a really dark, like a, I use that to get a really dark. But then recently I've been trying to focus on like maybe the 4H and the 2H, because I've always, usually I start off with an HB.
And like a light one.
Yeah, very light. I start off with the light one. And then I'll eventually go dark. But I've been trying to see what, you know, I'll go from an HB, 2B, 3B, as I said, and for really dark, so I'll go as high as a 9B. And then
almost like you use all of them.
Yeah, but I try to put about three or four. And as I said, I've been experimenting recently with the really light, like just the 2H and the 4H. I've been on the 3H too. I've been trying the other side just to see. I lose patience with it, though, because it is so light and it's sort of, you know, it takes time to like to figure out how to go from that to the other extreme. But I've been trying that a little bit as well, the other side of the HB.
It strikes me that like it's good for just sort of like planning, but you don't want your final mark to be the anything of the H. You want to stay in the B.
Yeah. For the most part, I tend to. Yeah.
I was relating to what you said about street photography, because I think I read that you were a photo major in San Francisco, San Francisco Art Institute. Yes. And I had also done a photo major myself. And I remember that feeling of being out on the street, trying to photograph people with these big medium format cameras, like, or even like there were techniques that people would use to not scare people, because putting a camera to your eye is a threatening gesture in a lot of ways. And I wonder if you found, like me, because we went through a time when cameras were analog and then they went digital. Now they're just in your phone. Have you found it easier to capture subjects with the phone? Because it's a little bit, you know, it's more surreptitious.
Yeah, it is easier. Yeah. I mean, and plus you don't have to worry about that shutter, the click from the shutter. So it is a lot easier, but you can still get caught. I was on the subway once and I thought I was being slick with my phone, and I was just trying to photograph this attractive young lady, but she was with her family, and the guy just said, time I took the picture, he saw it. He said, take that. He was really aggressive. So I erase it, in other words.
Oh, my God. That would scare me.
Yeah, that was, it's like, I, you know, some people, they just don't like the picture taken. So if somebody don't like their picture taken, I have no problem with deleting it. It's not a problem. Yeah.
It's like taking your life in your hands.
Particularly if you're on the streets, you don't know people, or you're trying to get that carte brisson, that decisive moment. You're always looking for that decisive moment. Some people are really good at it, but I can't fight, so.
No, thanks. We don't need any fighting like that. Yeah, but I always felt like you have to sort of be internally, you have to be a trespasser to be a good photographer. But I think my history of photography is fuzzy now, but I remember all the techniques people would use, like looking down into the viewfinder, keeping the camera at your belly button so that people don't know, because you're going to get in a fight otherwise. It's that's a threatening gesture.
Yeah. I've always, when I did it a lot, I would always photograph normally. Occasionally I'd do put the camera on my hip in front of my stomach. But in general, I would just, I try to judge, get a sense of the person before I, some people, they're going to get upset. And the ones that you think are not are just going to totally ignore you. Those are the ones I would try to photograph.
Yeah. And when the drawings are all exhibited, the drawings that you make from the photos or imagination, when they're all exhibited together, it almost feels like a community of people that know each other in a lot of ways, or a family.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's always been central with these drawings, these composite drawings, is that even if I don't know them, that there's like this this underlying sense of community that I'd like to see happen. I don't know how that happens, but I've always thought of like the image as being of someone that I knew at some point in my life. And that's sort of that's also the impetus behind why I choose certain images, because maybe that image on some level reminds me, or I could make it, or I feel that I could make it into somebody that I've had a relationship with in the past. Even though I never had that relationship, in certain cases, it could be somebody that I wanted to have a relationship with, or somebody I thought I had in the past. And so I'm always looking for that in the final sort of outcome of the drawing, is that it has a certain kind of familiarity to it.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, almost like you're searching for the familiar.
Yeah.
And then you do portraiture not only in drawing, you do it in painting as well. And the painting is a different style. It's like a very colorful expressionist style. I almost think they'd look wonderful in an exhibition, a two-person show with Max Beckmann, or kind of, they have a direct kind of forceful look. Again, they do feel like family or community. How do you approach your paintings? It's a different technique than your drawings.
Again, I work from photographs, again, still, sometimes even from my phone, which I do for the drawing as well, but I'd say I don't know if it's that much difference. I think all the work, whether it's a drawing or painting, there's a very sort of physical interaction with the work. I think in terms of my early influences, as far as looking at paintings go, I was definitely inspired by the German expressionist, Emil Nolde. That was some of the first painting that I thought that I could do, because some of the things that he did was like very simple, like a blob of paint for the eye and then just a dot for the pupil or something like that. So it was those kind of things that sort of attracted me to painting. And also I'd say some of the foes, like in particular Matisse's painting, Warm Wolf of Green Hat. But I could never get, I don't feel this is like, it's not at that level, but that type of painting has it's what is the impetus behind my painting. For it to be expressionistic in terms of application and color and feel.
Almost like you related to the act of distilling. Like when I think of Matisse portraits or Emil Nolde, I think of like they distill everything into this sort of few components, but it's also not necessarily about the actual person. It's more of a psychological portrait.
Yeah. I'd say it's more of a psychological thing that's happening. But there's this sort of relationship between like how the portrait interacts with the audience. That's very important to me. And so I guess you can say there's distillation that definitely takes place. Even though I'm learning to add more, there's still a lot that I'm leaving out in terms of like, you know, if I was like a photorealist or something like that. So in that respect, yeah, that's because it's more about this, what am I trying to say? It's more about the essence of the person. And so it's trying to convey that relationship with the audience through a sort of a essence. It's shorthand, but it's still complete.
That's a perfect segue because you also work in the medium of sculpture. And I've heard in other interviews that you say the sculptures are found objects or, you know, assemblage. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me as, I think I've heard you say it even in earlier interviews, that you think of that as almost a compliment to the portraits that you draw and paint, that it's the interior of a person. Could you talk a bit about how you make the sculptures, how you think about them?
Let's see. How could I say this? Well, I started doing, while I was at the Art Institute in San Francisco years ago. I worked in a lot of different mediums, and I did a lot of sculpture, but a lot of the sculpture I did there was from welding. I did a lot of welding with scrap metal. So I think part of the impetus for working with found materials, a part of the reason why I worked with found materials was from just welding together scrap pieces of metal from that. And also just in general from walking around neighborhoods while I was a student there. And then as growing up, I've always sort of like explored various neighborhoods. And then as a result of going to the Art Institute, I found out about like working with like, oh, you know, that you can make art out of almost any type of material. Because prior to that, my art education was not that steep. I didn't, when I went to California, I was not, you know, I went down to be a photography major. So my knowledge of art was very limited at that time. And so with the exception of maybe one brief visit to the Emory University Museum when I was like maybe 12th grade or something like that, and it was largely ethnographic. But while I was in California, my idea of what art could be sort of expanded. And then also I have to think about maybe African art as well. But in general, my art idea in terms of what I could make art out of expanded, and using that, I realized I didn't have to always have money to go like buy things.
Right.
in order to make it.
Collage state of mind.
Yeah, it's a collage state of mind, but it was just 3D. So I use things that are readily available. And I just like, in general, as I said, I've always sort of walked around. And so I'll, in the course of walking around, a lot of times I'll pick things up. And then at times, there's been points when I didn't have a studio. I'll start where I've used a lot of recycled things, things that I was going to throw away as well. So a lot of the sculpture is sort of based on a personal history that's derived from discarded materials, of things that I find on the street, as well as things that I may throw away. A lot of times I'll have things that I'm not going to use. They stopped working recently, and then I'll put them in one of my sculptures, right? I like my most recent sculpture actually has this digital scale that I had a few years ago, and it stopped working. And I just, you know, was just hanging around the studio, and it fit perfect with the sculpture. So all of the sculpture has a sort of personal history that informs it, whether it's based on like things I find on the street. It's usually a combination of things that I find on the street, as well as things somebody else may discard or things that I may reclaim or things that I no longer use. So to me, I guess that makes it a little bit more human on some level. It gives it that sort of history. Whereas if I was just working with plaster, it would be totally different. But I think in general that when you're working with sculpture, I mean, for me, how it differs and how it's similar to the photograph is that it has to have this sort of human connection. It has to have a sort of awareness in terms of how the viewer can respond to the work. So I use sort of found materials or reuse or reclaim materials. And then sometimes I start with a particular shape. I may start with a particular shape. Like at one time I did a bunch of sculptures that were based on the size of a milk crate. So I measured a milk crate and then I build a box cut out of just scrap pieces of wood. And I'll build this block maybe twice and then I'll start deviating from that. But it's usually a combination of things. But the outcome is to like think of it in terms of like a sort of internal reference.
Because they're very abstract, like they don't look like a person. They are an abstract assemblage sculpture. So it does feel almost pure psychology.
Yeah, I guess it's I guess you could say it's pure psychology. I think some of the recent things they're getting a little bit more figurative.
Oh yeah, there was one with like a silhouette of a face.
Face, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
That's the one that has the scale in it.
Oh, okay. Good to know. We'll put that in the Instagram carousel.
Yeah, that's the Instagram one. That's the one that has the scale in it. But that don't mean the next one will be like that, though. The next one could be, it could be totally abstract, so totally psychological. But I think that what makes it, for me, I think it has the way it's built or I don't know. I like to use the word built, but my idea of built is like it can be very precarious in how it's and how it's assembled. So I don't want to say built in terms of like, you know, something real defined. I don't want people to think it's something real defined, but it's just based on how I manipulate these materials. And in most cases, it's very sort of intuitive thing. And I just sort of work with it until it have this, I guess I'm looking for a sort of presence with maybe a sort of gesture or a sort of gait that somehow gives it a sort of humanness, if that's possible, or sort of presence, if you will. So,
yeah, I totally get that. You're kind of collaging and assemblaging until you feel that soul kind of come to life inside. And I think that's what we're all out for with our own work too, just looking for that living thing that ignites in there.
I don't know if I explained that too well.
It's hard to put into words. I think you've explained it perfectly. I think everyone who's listening is going to be like, oh yeah, of course. They're going to understand. Yeah. They're going to understand. A lot of artists listen. I wanted to circle back a little bit to your days as a student in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. In San Francisco, because I had seen on Instagram that, you know, you knew Margaret Kilgallen, that you were kind of adjacent to that mission school. If listeners don't know right off the top of their head, these artists, they made art for street art. It was in the 90s. They were inspired by folk art and using non-traditional materials. And so I guess I wanted to ask you if mingling with that group of artists, did that kind of inspire you to work in sculpture again with like folk art influence and found materials versus this kind of refined, you know, let's cast this thing in bronze style sculpture?
Well, you know, I think part of the reason why I work that way, a lot of it just is just economics, you know.
Right.
You know, I can't say that I don't know how much they did have some influence. I mean, but I was sort of on the periphery. I knew I had showed with Margaret and of course Chris Johansson is another one who's pretty well known now, and so I knew all of them, but I didn't ride a skateboard.
You weren't surfing. You weren't out there
I
surfing.
I didn't go surf.
7 a.m.
Yeah, see, they went surfing. I didn't do all that. But, you know, we would bump into each other. And pretty much everybody in the Bay Area, they showed at this place called the Luggage Store Gallery. And I showed that's actually where Margaret and I showed along with Terry Hoff. Yeah, so we all showed there. We all showed there together. And occasionally, you know, there was this bookstore, Adobe Books, where they would hang out. But I didn't go as often. You know, I would drop in occasionally. But I wasn't like in this serious clique, you know. I wasn't really. But I knew all those guys. But in terms of, I can't say, maybe it did. But it was also, I'm sure that had maybe something to do with my choice of materials. But by then, I was actually a little older than those guys, and I was already out of school. And so I had a real tiny studio, and I would just, again, primarily walk in the neighborhood, Western Addition, sort of where I lived at in Alamo Square in San Francisco, and pick up things and take them back to my studio. And I was definitely aware of what they was doing as well. So, you know, I'm sure that has a bit of an influence in terms of how I worked.
Just like for me, the great thing about them is that they were just open to everything. It didn't have to be a painting and in a gallery, or, you know, everything was allowed into the work.
You know, and I maybe touched on this earlier, even though I'm from the South, I didn't really learn about art so much until after I left the South. Other than, as I said, other than being a photographer, because I was always taking photographs, even as a kid growing up. I would go downtown Atlanta and photograph buildings, go to Piedmont Park and photograph people in the park, and photograph some of the landscape in the park. But in terms of having a general overall picture of what art is, I think I learned more about that when I was in San Francisco. And that's where I began to learn also about folk art as well. I wasn't that much aware of it when I was growing up in Atlanta. I think growing up in Atlanta, probably my biggest influence was I'd have to say late 60s, early 70s, well, 60s to 70s before I left. It's probably the civil rights movement. And so I think that had a bit of influence in terms of how I particularly like photograph things or what have you. And maybe in terms of the drawing, because a lot of this, it's all these faces. You know, it's a lot of portraiture. So I probably the biggest influence from the South. It's probably the civil rights. Maybe looking at the news daily,
and like seeing the people's faces printed in the newspaper.
Talking heads. Of course, Ebony and Jet magazine. You know, MLK, Stokely Carmichael, you know, well, that was MLK home. And being, as I said, I wasn't that much versed in art, you know, that knowledgeable in art until I started going to the Art Institute. But prior to that, I kind of saw, because even though I photographed a lot, I kind of saw that work as more of a documentary type approach to like art. So, because I said, I would just walk around, photograph different things in Atlanta, and then family members as well. But I ultimately saw photography as sort of a documentary approach.
I'm interested in the almost document, like journalistic urge that you were engaged in Atlanta during the civil rights. Because it makes so much sense to how the portrait, the drawing portraits, it just makes a great connection for me. And I'm wondering if you feel like with the art world as it is now, which, you know, it's not really the most diverse place on earth. Do you feel like by putting forth these portraits that you're helping de-other in a racial way, like showing Black faces versus what the art world seems to kind of put out there more?
Well, there's plenty of artists that are doing, you know, Black people, right? I'm just one of many. So, you know, I think of it, a lot of it has to do with, you know, on some levels, all the artists, it's always going to be that way. I think a lot of it has to do with economics, you know. Probably more successful artists, they're able to, like, do a certain type of imagery, whereas others that aren't as successful or don't have the economics or a certain type of backing, they could do the same type of work, but it won't get the recognition. So, but there are a lot of young and contemporary artists of color that are doing and getting a lot of acceptance in terms of their work. Now, could there be more? Of course, but
You feel like things have improved in your lifetime.
They definitely have improved in my lifetime. But I wish they had been like this 20 years.
I know.
I don't know. Like when I say in terms of like civil rights, like in high school, I was with certain organizations. I did like a couple marches and stuff. But a lot of my photography was just people. It was family occasionally, and then strangers. But because I hadn't went to a school, I didn't have like the guts that I did afterwards, you know, to even go to that extent. Occasionally, I would photograph people, but it would usually be like where there would be a big gathering of people, like at a fair or something, a street festival, where it's a lot easier to photograph people.
But
growing up in Atlanta in the 60s and 70s, the civil rights movement, it was, you know, with MLK, Kennedy. MLK died in 68, and I was in the seventh grade I remember when he got shot. I was in the seventh grade. So all of that, all of those things, it definitely had a big impact in terms of, like, as I said, in terms of like how I maybe my portraiture. And I don't know, being from the South, people, they want, there's always, or being from anywhere, people want to sort of put you, they want to label you. But for me, I thought that the biggest label, or label that's more accurate, was the mediated influences that I went through as a youth and as an adult.
The South. I'm from the South too, and it's an intense place. It sounds like you were really in the heart of the movement there, and it must have been a really intense way when you were growing up.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I was at the heart.
Right? Birthplace.
Well, yeah. Atlanta. Yeah. But I don't, it's just,
I guess it wasn't Mississippi or, you know, well, Alabama.
Yeah. It's weird how a lot of, I feel like it doesn't, I mean, when you see a lot of artists that are not from the South talk about that influence, talk about the civil rights, or when they try to put it in context of art, to me, I feel like they sort of ignore where it came from. They try to reclaim it, in other words.
I guess it ended up being a universal
Yeah, that's what
movement, but there was some, there's just something about the way it was in the South. I imagine that it felt really dangerous to be a person of color. And then, yeah, and then having Martin Luther King, boy, I mean, that's sort of an ownership, almost like, you know, I don't know, imagine like New Yorkers feel about 9/11. Like, yeah, the whole country felt attacked, but New Yorkers really felt attacked, like a little bit of that intensity.
Definitely, yeah.
Amy here with a quick word from our sponsor, the New York Studio School. Transform your art practice this summer at the New York Studio School with 10-day marathons in drawing, painting, and sculpture. With three sessions running from June to July 2024, the New York Studio School marathons engage the practices of drawing, painting, and sculpture as a way to understand one's own experience in the world. Artists will use a wide range of visual languages and first-hand strategies aimed at expanding their work and vision. Marathons are limited in size, too, to ensure quality feedback and meaningful dialogue. On tap are courses like Painting the Landscape at Old Westbury Gardens with Rachel Rickard that invite students to paint the plein air landscape, or The Mask, the Wing, and the Mirror with Sam Levy, Caitlin McDonough, and Clintel Steed, which encourages students to focus on personal symbols through study of Roman art history and field trips to the Met, plus many more. This summer, join the expansive New York Studio School community either in person at their Skylit Greenwich Village studio or virtually from your home studio. Marathons are open to artists of all levels of experience, and generous partial scholarships are available. Visit NYSS.org to learn more and enroll today. Okay, back to the episode. And I had mentioned your work in a previous podcast about this show, this British show called Portrait Artist of the Year. Have you ever heard of it?
Oh, actually, I've watched that a couple
it's
times.
It's good, right? It's relaxing. Yeah. Well, I had mentioned your work because they're all on a quest for likeness, you know, and I was very interested in your work because your quest for quote unquote likeness is so wide ranging. You've got the internal likeness of the sculpture. You've got the external likeness of the portraiture. And I just really admire you as an artist because you have such a freedom in your work. You use several mediums to express different ideas. You work in drawing, as we mentioned, sculpture, painting, but you also do photography and also digital collage. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, your philosophy as an artist in terms of really embracing many mediums to get your ideas across?
Yeah, let's see.
Like, how important is it? Because you didn't pick one thing and just kind of do it. You know, you allow yourself freedom.
Yeah, I don't know. I know when I was at the art, again, I have to go back to the artists too. They always encourage you to, you know, to work on a lot of different mediums, to experiment. And afterwards, I continued to like, I was doing a lot of welding there. And after I graduated, I didn't have enough money to like set up a welding shop. Yeah. So
that sounds like it'd be expensive.
Pretty expensive, yeah. So I would do it in spots every now and then. I would, and in the meantime, if I didn't find a spot, I would just start gathering things from the streets. And I've always sort of jumped around from drawing to painting to sculpture, but the drawing I got the most recognition from it earlier than the other mediums, and maybe to an extent. Well, up until recently. And so there was always this pressure to like, just, why don't you just draw, you know, but I don't know, for some reason that was never stressed as much when I was in school, because even when I did my little thesis show, I had paintings and sculpture in the thesis show. So by the time I left school, I still continued to do drawing painting, and then sculpture. In the Bay Area, I was doing a lot of relief type, more like Rauschenberg-like constructions. I was doing more, they were more constructions, where I work on like a panel, wood panel, and build out from that. And like some of these sculptures, some of these recent sculptures, I can see where they have a bit of that influence in terms of like building out from a flat surface, building out towards a 3D from a sort of a flat surface. But in the Bay Area, I was just primarily doing a lot of 3D construction pieces. But I've always like sort of jumped around, even though I know that maybe there's always been this pressure just to just draw. Why don't you just draw?
Did right? you feel that pressure from galleries and that sort of thing? Market, the market?
I never had a big market. So maybe that's why.
You kind of stayed free because a little bit under the radar.
A little bit under the radar, or, showing in nonprofits where it doesn't really matter so much.
So you're really accomplished. I mean, just to set the record straight, you've won prestigious grants and collected by museums. You know, you're very humble in the way you speak, but you're a very accomplished artist. But that doesn't always translate to market, the contemporary art market, unfortunately. So I guess in a way, you stayed free because you didn't have that intense pressure, or maybe you would have stood up to it anyway and kept doing what you're doing.
I don't know, maybe. I probably would have, you have to do what you have to do to survive. But there was never, there was always some pressure. And so, but I never had like, I was never with a gallery where I was making a lot of money. So.
You weren't like the cash cow.
Yeah, yes.
So you didn't feel like you needed to help them pay the rent.
Yeah, so if they don't need you for that, they don't really care. They'll come over and say, we'll just take that. And you can keep doing that other stuff.
Yeah, enjoy doing that. We'll take that.
we're just interested in this right here. I've always just sort of, I don't know, maybe at some point I will just focus on one thing. I don't know.
I mean, you got to do you, but I just admire that freedom in your work. I find it inspiring.
Thank you. Yeah. So.
And then I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions. Sometimes you draw like brick walls. Yeah. And I love the way they look when they're kind of exhibited with the portraits.
Yeah.
Why do you do the brick wall drawings?
Okay. Again, a lot of a big thing with a sort of an overriding theme with my work is these sort of, sometimes I think of the work as iconic, like iconic and sort of symbolic.
Yeah.
I think of like certain types of imagery that, what's the word I'm looking for? That kind of goes along well or blends well within like certain working class communities. Like if you grew up in a certain socioeconomic background, particularly in the urban center, you maybe at some point, if you didn't live in the projects, you knew somebody that lived in the projects. And a lot of those things were built, when they were first built, they were made out of bricks. They were built. And then they was put next to like middle income, people with middle incomes, as they were put there. And the purpose was hopefully at some point, these working class people will, they'll learn from these middle class people and they'll learn how to, better themselves or whatever. But that's where they were placed. So you can still see that today, how they'll put low income housing next to like, where people say they don't want it. Not in my neighborhood.
Right.
That's something they've been doing since they first built. But basically, the impetus behind doing that was like when I was growing up, believe it or not, I thought that I lived in projects briefly, but we always like lived in these apartments. We finally got a house like much later on, but then My mother was offered the opportunity to buy it, and she didn't want to buy it. But basically, I saw this brick wall, like, for years. I mean, I have some old, real old paintings back in San Francisco of built of walls. Maybe they can also be interpreted as buildings. But this brick wall, for me, it's just a symbol of a certain, like, it's also kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's diaristic, because for the ones that I did not too long ago, I named them all after places that I had lived in Atlanta or San Francisco or here. But for me, the symbol, the brick wall itself, I've sort of associated for a long time with sort of, you know, people who lived in, that was from working class communities. And that's primarily why I used it. But since I know that that's not really true, because, you know, really rich people live in brick buildings.
But it's like a symbol of home.
Yeah,
a little
yeah.
Bit.
Just, but it's more of a symbol of home. And so instead of doing the whole house, I just did like the brick wall. And so it sort of identifies a place, you know, and if you give it a certain name, it has other associations, gives a little bit of a history, but it's just a symbol that I feel, a universal symbol that I feel that I can use to, like, add content that's significant to, like, working class people. That's primarily what it is. It's something that I, and it's not like there's a brick building for a particular portrait. They don't have to work together. The whole idea is not, they can work completely separate, but that whole idea is, again, it's another layer to, like, the portraiture without actually being, you know, it adds another layer to, like, the portraiture without having to, like, actually, it doesn't have to sit next to it. In some ways, it's still just like the portrait. It's just a portrait of a place without actually having to be the, I don't have to be descriptive and, like, go into so much detail, but I just thought it was just another layer that could exist with the portraits or without, and it's a way of describing, like, a certain part of Americana without, you know, without all of, just a different sort of way that, you know, it says the same thing as the portraits, but in a different
way.
Yeah,
like, it's like the portraits, it's a little bit general, but also extremely personal. It's like the two opposites at once, and you're not, like, locking it down into this person is, you know, Aunt Maud. It's like a symbol of Aunt Maud or a symbol of an aunt, and then you have the brick wall, which is sort of a symbol. And walking around in New York too, it's like the brick wall is such a foundation for so many things. Like, you'll see these memorials to people who've been killed, big graffiti paintings. And just a couple of days ago, I was walking by one that was a really complex memorial to pets, lost pets. And it's like cats and dogs and their names, like Misty and, you know, like Rover and their dates. And, like, it was just so strange. But the brick wall also is like a base for graffiti. So I like the idea that you're putting it in as this sort of open symbol that could conjure many associations to the viewer. But to you, it's almost like a personal symbol of home.
Yeah. Pretty. That's it. I guess that's it.
It's a powerful base for a lot of things in New York, and probably Atlanta too.
Yeah.
So I've been interested in how sculptors, a common complaint of sculptors is, how do you store it all? And I just wanted to ask you, what's your approach to sculpture, and where do you stick it?
I don't know. I just moved into this studio, but I had to bring so much with me, so it's almost like my studio's become a storage space.
So it's always the way.
Yeah, so I don't have as much room to work, and then I have storage space too. So, you know, I just I try
a
not
lot
to
of sculptors complain about needing storage space. It's just, like, inevitable.
Yeah, it's inevitable, you know. And I try not to think about if I start thinking about where I'm going to put it before I build it, I'll never build it. You know, so I just do it and then I see where it fits.
That's smart, but, because you could talk yourself out of a lot of stuff worrying where you're going to store it.
Yeah, if you start, because I have some recent things that I did, if I thought about where I was going to put them, yeah, I wouldn't have made them. So
you got to stay in a state of delusion.
Yeah, state in my mind. You know, I have a bunch of sculptures in my mind though that I think about a lot. I don't know if they're ever getting made because I am running out of space. But I mean, I like sculpture just because it's, you know, it's three, just because it takes up space. And I think you can do a lot more with it than you can with a painting. You know, I think painting, you still have to be kind of literal. I mean, there are just pure abstract painters, but I still think the ideas that come from sculpture can be a lot more layered, but at the same time, they make a lot more sense sometimes than a painting. And I think in general, all my painting is sort of sculpture anyway. I think I'm not so much trying, I'm trying to pull the form out of the painting as opposed to like this illusionistic space and rectangle.
That makes sense to me, because your work, especially the paintings, are really impostoed. They have a real sculptural feeling to them.
Yeah, so I still like paintings. I like sculpture. But again, I try not to think about where I'm going to put it. But my studio is getting smaller and smaller every day.
Oh, no, it's the worst. I know there's got to be some kind of solution out there for all the sculptors who are just, because it's the painters don't have that burden in a lot of ways, because you're just trying. I mean, they're large, but you could always unstretch. It's only 2 inches wide. And there's something about sculpture, just mounds and mounds and mounds. So because the podcast is Pep Talks for Artists, sometimes I like to ask artists if they have any advice for either their younger self or another, you know, younger artists. Sometimes it's a good opportunity to ask artists. So I was wondering if you had any off the top of your head.
Any advice for if I was, you mean for the younger me?
Yeah, or some younger artists, what would you tell them?
I tell them to get with, I you know, it's hard to say, but the most important thing is to have some kind of support, I think. And, you know, have some support from people that believe in you and not from people that, you know, want to change you or people that have already made up their mind about what you're capable of. Have people around you that want to help you realize your dream. Be aggressive. And in some cases, some artists work good in groups. You know, like collaborative. I think that's good if it works for you. Otherwise, you know, it's okay to work alone. But the biggest thing is that even if you're working by yourself, the biggest thing is have some support. It's to have people or associate yourself with people that believe in what you're doing. And I think if you can do that, it'll improve your chances of like making it in the long run. But you got to have a support. You got to have some kind of base,
like, you know, peer group or mentors.
Yeah. I mean, I've had opportunities to like have some really great mentors, but I sort of dropped the ball. So I say mentors. Yeah. Mentors, peer groups, a combination of things. I can't say one is better than the other, but you know, whatever kind of support is good that you can work with, you know, but have that, you know, if you're young, maybe both peer groups and like mentor. But definitely, I can't say which one, because some people have mentors and, you know, and some have support groups, but Definitely, you got to have people, or you have to associate with people that believe in your ability to make it as an artist, and not just somebody who knew you one way and want you to stay that way.
Yeah.
And if being that way, as long as being that way has something to do with art, that's fine. But, you know, if they want you to be a certain way, and you weren't an artist 5 years ago, or when you guys were in high school, you can't be an artist now.
Mm-hmm. They say you can't be a hero in your hometown.
Yeah. So, you know, that's, you don't want that kind of person, but, you know, find people that'll support what you do. And I think that's the most important thing. Find people that'll support what you do, and, you know, and push yourself until you get to where you think you need to be.
When you're saying they believe in you and they pushing you, are they pushing you out of your shyness in terms of going out there and put yourself out there? Or are they pushing you out of your fear of going forward in your work?
Maybe it's I think it has to be both, you know, it has to be both. But then some people, they, you know, like I said, they just want you to do one thing.
I've met those people.
Yeah.
I think we all have. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's hard. Maybe it's hard to find somebody that'll do both. You know, some people, they don't want to.
True.
Yeah. They can only do one. So you may have to have a couple. You know, you might have somebody that'll push you out of your shyness, and somebody that'll encourage you to do other things. But ultimately, you still have to decide what's good for you, because sometimes people will suggest things that may not be good for you. You know, they could just tell you things just to distract you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you gotta watch out. When you find somebody that's you know, on your side like that, you gotta hold on with death grip.
Yeah. So you know, it's hard, but it's still good to have somebody, some kind of support. You know,
it's essential, because you know a career is up and down too.
Yeah, and I guess that you can apply that to anything. It doesn't have to necessarily have to be an artist. You can apply that to anything.
That's true.
No matter what it is in life.
Don't try to do it alone.
Yeah, you got to have some kind of support, no matter what it is.
That's really good advice. I love these moments on the podcast, because I'm just like, I need it too. I need the advice also. But that kind of finishes with my questions, but I wanted to give you a chance to tell us about your upcoming show so that people might be able to see your work in real life. I know you have one coming up, Yeah, once this podcast is out, it will have opened, but it'll still be running. So,
yeah, it's on the Wharf for Painters at Provincetown Art Association and Museum in Provincetown, Massachusetts. PAAM. The open is May 10th. I think it's May 10th to June 16th. Yeah. So basically, it's an award that they give out every year to like old painters.
Oh, hush. Old painters.
Old 45.
Oh, well, okay. That's rude.
Yeah, it's an old dude.
That's not old.
Yeah, because, see, there's not a lot of awards out there for, that's another thing. There's not a lot of awards out there for older artists. A lot of awards out there are usually for, like, you know, by the time you're 30, if you ain't got it by the time you're 30 or 35, you can forget about it.
Yeah.
So that's one of the few out there that's for older artists. You know, I'm grateful for that. I'm glad I was lucky to get it. I've applied for it several times, and I got it. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, it's called it's prestigious. It's the Lillian Orlowski and William Fried Grant.
Yeah, I forgot that part. That's the most important part.
And you can find out more at paam.org.
That
grant. Yeah. Well, that's wonderful that supporting, I refuse to say old, more mature artists.
Okay. Yeah. Mature artists. That sounds better.
Congratulations on that. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Well deserved. And you're also on Instagram a lot. You have a great feed. People should find you at FHAY underscore. Is it at 00?
Yeah, underscore 00.
And then your website is fredhaysstudio.com. And I'll put all links to all these things in the podcast description. So I just want to thank you, Fred, so much for giving your time so generously to the podcast. I really enjoyed hearing more about your work and getting all these insights into it. Like I said, I'm a huge, huge fan, and I just enjoyed every second. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me, and hopefully I made a little sense.
You made perfect sense. I think everyone's going to love it. I mean, it made sense to me. You were amazing. All right, I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Pep Talks for Artists. A huge, huge thank you to Fred Hayes for giving so generously of his time to answer all my questions about his work. You can see more of Fred's work at his website, fredhaysstudio.com, or on Instagram at fhay_00. And a little reminder that his next show will be at the Provincetown Art Association and Museum through June 16th, 2024. And more info for that show can be found at paam.org. Pep Talks is online too at peptalksforartists.com and on Instagram at peptalksforartists, where I post images to go with each episode, including this one. So check it out. I am online too at amytoludo.com or on Instagram at Talutes. A big thank you also to Pep Talks patrons. And a special shout out to Courtney Puckett for her Buy Me a Coffee donation this month. Thanks, Courtney. And also a big thank you to you for listening. I really appreciate you stopping by, and I'll see you next time. Good night. Thank you.